Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
You know, when you take a long journey, it's always best to have a great game plan, a map to know exactly where you're going to go, but we don't always do that in life. Well, my friend Sean Conley had a great roadmap for his life, what he wanted to do, and we're going to continue it in part two of this segment, talking to Sean Conley, a kicker in the NFL and a guy that succeeded at life and wrote a book about it, The Point After by Sean Conley. We have part two of his story coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And if you missed our episode we had yesterday, episode number 390 of season two of Pigskin Dispatch podcast, you have a great, good one. You'll have to go back and listen to it because this is part two of our interview with my friend Sean Conley that we grew up together and played some street ball. And in the first part, just a summary, we had a conversation with Sean, how he started off as a youngster, 8 years old, focused on his father was a big influence in his life, got him involved in punt, pass, and kick. He went to a couple of those competitions, sort of working at his and honing his skill, playing some soccer and everything. But he had a goal in mind. He didn't have high school football at his high school, and he went and played some Division III was his plan. He walk on at a Division I program to be their starting kicker and go in the NFL. And he's already went through and made the Division III. So let's get tune in right now with Sean as we pick up right before he goes into Division I football. All right, let's go back to that 1992 Pitt Panther season. Mm. I mean, just to make everybody remember, you know, Pitt was only in the second year of belonging to a conference. You know, they second year in the Big East. Before that, right. They were an independent team. They were 3 years removed from being, you know, in the top 20, probably about half a decade from or so of, you know, some of the really great teams, or maybe a decade, you know, the Marinos and, you know, back when we were a kid, Tony Dorsett and, right. And things like that playing for him. So a great program, and you walk on there, beat out, you know, scholarship athletes that are there for kicking, but there's some guys on the team that are from your hometown, and Erie's about a 2 hour drive, about 100 miles from, the middle of Pittsburgh where Pitt is. And yet you have some guys from Erie that played football. And did you have relationships with them before you went down there? And I'm talking about there was Dietrich Gels and Tim Colicchio and Mike Eberle, who you reminded me of before we came on.
Right, right. No, I didn't know them at all until I went down there. But like immediately, you know, it was like, you know, like Erie boys, like, you know, we get together. So I met them like super early and, you know, end up good friends with all of them. You know, especially like Tim Colicchio. Yeah, and Dietrich Gels went to high school just a couple blocks away from me. So, and yeah, he ended up going on to the Philadelphia Eagles. I think he played 3 years. I think he got his 3 years in. Yeah, and it was great because we actually had a lot of you know, for Erie, we had the local TV stations and newspapers. They were down at all the games because of all the Erie players. And now Pitt had James Conner, who now is probably, I guess, the most famous Erie to Pittsburgh connection, and Mark Stepnowski,
right?
Of course,
right,
right.
And now, when you were at Pitt, that they used to. I'm originally from Edinburgh, and I went. That's where I ended up going to college, was Edinburgh University, which is probably about 15 miles south of Erie. And Pitt used to come up and have their spring training with Edinburgh in conjunction with Edinburgh, and they'd have it And you're, did you, were you part, was that?
Oh, I didn't know that. No, I did not know that.
Yeah. I know when Steps was there, I was in, I was in college at Edinburgh and I was like playing racquetball or something. And that's the racquetball hallway was like where the locker room was. And of course the Pitt players would come out and, you know, us guys in racquetball gear, we're like trying to hug the walls, you know, so we don't get squished by these monsters coming through. And that went, so I'm just trying to not make eye contact. All of a sudden I have like a hand grab me. I'm like, oh shit, somebody's going to mess with me. And here, you know, Mark Stepnoski's there and says, hey, how you doing? Like, wow, pretty cool. But Dietrich Gels, you know, I was a young official and I officiated some of his games and I was a line judge. And back then it was all 5-man crews and officiating. And what happens is, it's really before you had a lot of spread offenses, but Tech Memorial, as you said, you know, I think Pete Petriani might've been the coach of Tech when Gels played.
Or maybe Costello
could have been there. Yeah. Cause yeah. That's right. He went to, but Petriani, I know, was on the staff.
Yeah,
I
believe. That's right.
So I had their sideline. I had Tech sideline. And whenever the back judge, who's sort of in the behind the umpire, deep behind the safeties and the defense, he would cheat to the side, the strong side, because he would take that widest receiver on that side. So if I was on the weak side, I had to make sure I had coverage of, you know, the whole passing effect of the receiver on my side. You know, they would always sort of strong side and put Gels to the weak side. And I have Tech, you know, coaches right on my, you know, breathing right down my neck. So Gels, and I have to start the line of scrimmage. I'm a line judge. So Gels takes off, runs like a, you know, a fly pattern, and they, you know, quarterback launches a pass under. And I'm, you know, of course I can't, I'm only like 20 some years old. I can't keep up with this kid. He's got, you know, grease lightning for feet there. And they run like two or three times, and you know, it wasn't a very effective offense, but it would tire out a line judge for sure. And I remember coming back and the Tech coaching staff's like, hey, you want us to run that one more time? I'm like, oh, no, that's okay. This kid's fast. He's a good athlete, Dietrich Gels. And Timmy Colicchio, I mean, he's probably one of the greatest running backs ever in Erie County. And he ended up having to play at the same time as probably the best running back. And that was Brian Milne, that played for Fort LaBeouf and went on to play at Penn State and also went in the NFL.
Right, yeah. And then Timmy Colicchio, he backed up Curtis Martin at Pitt. And then Curtis got hurt in our it's either our first or second game of the season. Then Tim had to carry the load the rest of the way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Curtis Martin, man, that's one of the greatest backs in NFL history and college history. Just a tremendous. Did you have a relationship with Curtis Martin at all?
Yeah. Well, it, crazy as it is, so he was injured that whole season, and you know, kickers, what we would do is for practice, we sometimes go up for about a half an hour, get our kicks in. And then, you know, we'd come back into the locker room, you know, hot tub, ice baths, you know, stretch, that kind of thing. So anyways, Kurt was, you know, rehabbing most of that season. And, you know, so one day his locker was right next to mine, and we were just talking, and he shared me with his story, that he didn't get into football. He didn't start playing football until it was either his sophomore or junior year in high school. And he said the reason being was the gym teacher told him he needed to play football. You know, he has a pretty tragic story. He you know, there was you know, he lost some family members, you know, with gun violence growing up. And so he was, you know, the coach thought, I mean, you can actually, if you Google like his speech, his Hall of Fame speech, he tells the story much better than I do, but he said, yeah, like the coach wanted him the gym teacher wanted me to play, said, hey, this will be good for you. And so he did. So he joined the football team, and then, you know, he's played like one or two games. Next, you know, like Pitt, Notre Dame are offering him scholarships. And he told me, like, you know what, because I'm not even really all that much into football. Like, I'm doing it because I needed to, but I'm just like really not that much into it. But then he, you know, I did run into him later, and he did get in, you know, like I think it charged him later. Cause I think at first he was trying to like adjust to the whole thing, but you know, Bill Parcells, I think once he got with Bill Parcells and when he got drafted, that just changed everything. Cause that came out of nowhere. I don't think anyone was expecting that he would go from, I believe he was a third round draft pick, to being one of the best running backs of all time.
But well, you know how, I mean, I'm a lifelong Steelers fan. You living down in Pittsburgh, you know how the media is, and it's those big regrets of missing out on those hometown guys like the Dan Marinos. Well, Curtis Martin's probably second on the list that everybody regrets. Like, why didn't the Steelers take him? They had a chance to get him. They could have had one of the best, you know?
Right. Well, luckily the Steelers went for Pickett this year. So like, I don't really follow specific teams. I follow players. And so, yeah. So Kenny Pickett and James Conner. Yeah. Anybody from Pitt, I cheer hard for.
Yeah. You know, and James Conner, I'm glad you mentioned him. He is such a great kid, great athlete. I'm not a kid anymore.
But under recruited.
Right. And he just, I mean, he's had all that fame with the Steelers, having some success with the Cardinals. I think he was leading the NFL at one point in touchdowns last year.
Big year last year. Yep.
And it's just my daughter goes to McDowell High School where Conner attended. And she just told me, you know, from Snapchat or something, a couple of her friends in school said, hey, Conner just showed up at their, they just had a mini camp. He showed up there and worked out with the guys for a day and just made the spirits of these kids, you know, his former alma mater, you know, just, really brightened their day. And even people like my daughter weren't even there, like, going, hey, James Conner was there practicing with the guys and giving them some pointers or anything. So that just tells you how, you know, half a country away is where he's playing football, and he spends time back in his hometown and helping boys that are trying to get to where he is. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Aaron Donald's the same. He has a house here in Pittsburgh and he does all kinds of amazing things for the community. So yeah, he's in the same mold.
That's just great stories there. Okay, so you're in the Pitt season. I guess we got to mention who your quarterback was. Was it Alex Van
Pelt? Alex Van Pelt. Yep. So, who broke a lot of the Marino records, actually.
And I think Alex ended up playing with the Buffalo Bills, I think, for a while, and been coaching ever since. I think he's still coaching, if I'm not mistaken. So
last I knew he was with the Browns.
Okay. Yeah, I don't get to follow the assistant coaches too much, but I know when I hear the names like that, especially the local guys that played D1 and stuff, I take an ear out for that. Okay, so you're in the Pitt season, and you just said earlier that you're one of the highest scoring teams in the nation in D1. Now, where was the most high pressure moment as a kicker for you at the college level? Do you have a specific instance or something that really sticks in your brain?
So, you know, because I had the 2 years at Gannon and the one at the Grove City, I only had 1 year of eligibility. So I played 1 year at Pitt. And that season, unfortunately, we had mega talent. Like some of the players we talked about, but we had so many injuries. There was another guy, I don't remember the name, Tom Tumulty, who ended up playing for the Cincinnati Bengals. But losing Curtis Martin in the beginning of the season, and then there was like five or six other starters that ended up playing the NFL that all got injured in the first couple of weeks. We were like, so depleted. Yeah, we end up going 3-9. So I never really had any big pressure games or kicks. I guess the biggest pressure kicks I had was early in the season, because I was as a walk on, I was playing ahead of these scholarship guys. I missed two kicks in a row. I missed an extra point against WVU, and then my first kick, our next game was against Rutgers on a Thursday night on ESPN, and I missed my first kick there. So that was two in a row, and I heard the head coach, is Paul Hackett. He came over to the special teams coach, Amos Jones, and he said to him, you know, if he misses one more, we're putting in Eddie Frazier. He was the backup. I'm like, oh shit. So I had to make the next kick. And so, so no for pressure. Me, yeah. So that was definitely like the biggest pressure kick I made. And I made that. And luckily after that, I made every single kick the rest of the season until, I had one blocked on the last game, when we played at Hawaii. But yeah, so that
you can always blame that on the lineman or something. You know, hey,
I blamed it on the snapper. Yeah, it was a high snap. Yeah, it was a snapper.
Oh, you don't want to blame a snapper. That's one of your three guys, man. You got them on like the guard or something. You can't see that. that's pretty neat. Now, okay, when you got these games, you're in all different kinds of situations. We already talked about the different turfs you're playing off. What about the weather? Is that like a big factor to you? You know, you talked about you're used to playing on snow. I know that for a fact. And you said you practice in the snow and all kinds of things, unless you're, Charlie Bauman, we talked about earlier, when you went to the Patriots, maybe they trained with a snowblower coming out and blowing off the snow, as we saw in a game one time. But how do you, mentally prepare for those type of things, the rain, the snow, the, you know, maybe it's a really dry grass field. Maybe that has a different effect. How do you account for some of those things?
Yeah, I think the best way is, you know, is to not, you know, like kind of like what Matt Barr said, not put too much into there where you change your whole routine or anything like that, because it's very easy to get caught up. You know, the worst conditions, of course, is like when it's cold, because the colder it is, the football is not going to fly as much. And you know, the wind, it can be a factor to a certain degree, but it really shouldn't change. Like if you're kicking into the wind, if you kick and if you hit the sweet spot, it'll still travel straight. I think what happens to a lot of kickers is we just start to think wind, I'm kicking into the wind. So is whatever you started that conversation, that's when it would throw you off, versus like, you know, stick with your routine. If you hit that sweet spot and you kick it like you always kicked it, you're going to kick it straight and it's going to go through. What kickers will do too is before the game is they'll kick in both directions, and you know they'll typically then communicate with the special teams coach, you know, based on the wind direction. Like if we're going that end of the stadium, I'm good to, you know, say it's into the wind, I'm good to 50. If we're going in that direction with the wind in my back, I'm good at like 65. So usually, and then the special teams coach can override you based on, you know, because kickers will usually say, you know, a few yards more than what they actually could do. and then that special teams coach is now in charge of, you know, when it happens in the moment, you know, to the head coach making a decision like, hey, this is out of the range of this way, or this is within the range. So that's usually the most important part of the communication when it comes to the wind.
Okay. So I guess along with that, did this ever happen? You know, Coach Hackett's on the sideline, the offense is out there, you know, Van Pelt and, you know, Colicchio and Gels and them, they end up getting a situation. It's 4th and 3 and, yeah, you're, you know, 34, 35 yard line, you know, those sort of the fringe areas for a kicker. Does Hackett look, did he look to you, or does he look to Coach Jones to say, hey, you know, can you make this, or, you know, should we go for it, or punt, or what? Where's
that decision come from? That would go to the special teams coach. Yeah. I mean, cause the kickers are like, yeah, I can make it, but yeah, that's
okay.
That would be Amos Jones's job. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's fast forward in your career. Now you're done with Pitt. You know, you have had a pretty successful career there. And what's your game plan now? You're done. You got your D1 job kicking for the Pitt Panthers. Where did your plan roll out from there, and what actually happened?
Yeah, I hoped to get drafted. So I had a good enough year to get drafted. I was 16 out of 19 my senior year, which was like, I don't know, what is that, like 84%. And so I think I was number two in the country. There was a kicker from Memphis who had a higher percentage. So I was number two accuracy wise. So I tried to get an agent. I had a hard time getting an agent because a lot of agents have no interest in kickers unless, like, at the time, like maybe you're like Jason Hansen or Jason Elam, you know, these kickers who would go like in the, you know, top couple rounds, which is like rarely happens. So finally I got an agent, and then he started like putting out all the calls, and it actually went fairly well. That year there was like four or five teams that needed kickers. So we were in contact with quite a few teams that said, hey, when he's around, or if he's available in the later rounds, we'll draft him. Unfortunately that didn't happen.
Did you get any visits with them in the draft process?
So the Giants came in and worked me out. Also we had like a pro day at Pitt where I had a little bit of an opportunity. But most of my work, when I played against Notre Dame, there was a lot of, like, we heard there was a whole bunch of scouts that were there. So I know I got to play live there, which is actually how I got signed by Detroit Lions. So then, and I also sent out videotape. Like I sent a highlight reel to every NFL special teams coach. So I did everything I could from a marketing perspective. And, you know, back then, like you really had to do like a lot of legwork on your own. You had to physically send tape. It wasn't like you could just like send them, you know, YouTube link. So I had to go down, and I met with our camera guy, our video guy at Pitt, and said, hey, can you put this together? And it took a really long time, cause I had to like, you know, like I want this kick. So he put it all together, and then he made me a bunch of copies, and I think I bought him a couple beers, but, But that's how you had to do it, unless you're like a top pick. But, you know, I knew I wasn't going to be a top pick, and I'd be really, really lucky if I got drafted. But no, I didn't get drafted, but because I had enough exposure through the other means, I got three calls once the draft ended. You know, like I was sitting there watching it. I remember, you know, we had ESPN in the dorm room, and this is the first year the NFL draft went from 12 rounds down to 7. I think if there was more rounds, I would have got drafted. So that was it. And then I was like, oh, shit. And I just waited. I waited, and I was about to give up on the phone ringing, and then it rang, and then it was Detroit Lions, and I hung it up, and then you know, I didn't have call waiting on my phone, so but I hung it up, and then it was Arizona Cardinals, who were the Phoenix Cardinals at the time, and then the Steelers called. So all three called and made some kind of free agent offer, and so the next day I worked out for the Steelers, and the Steelers said, actually, I got to meet with Bill Cowher. Like, so after the kicking workout, Bill Cowher, the coach, like, Bill, the coach wants to see you. I'm like, the coach. I mean, is it the special teams coach? I'm like, well, it can't be, because I already, you know, he was already out here. And they walk me in. I'm like, oh shit, I'm heading towards the head coach's office. And so I walk in, yeah. And then so I met with Bill Cowher, which was amazing. And he just said, hey, we'd love to sign you, but we can't sign you. I forget whatever the reasons were, like for a couple of weeks because of their roster or whatever. And then he says, do you have any other offers? I said, yeah, Detroit Lions offered me. And they said, if I sign with them, they would promise me playing time, which for kickers, that's what you really want to hear, that they'll promise you playing time. Because if you get playing time in preseason, you get video, and then I can take that video and I can send it out to other teams if and when I get cut. So he said, you need to sign with Detroit. That's my friend, Kevin Colbert. Cause Kevin Colbert now, who just retired with the Steelers.
Right.
He's like, yeah, you know, go play for Kevin. If Kevin said he'll play you. And yeah, cause Kevin Colbert was the player personnel director for the Detroit Lions back in 1993. So he's like, yeah, you got to go play for Kevin. So yeah. So then, you know, I got into the Three River Stadium parking lot with my buddy. I'm like, take me back to my room right now. I'm calling Detroit. I'm going to sign with them. And then that's where I ended up. So it was, you know, luckily, like from some advice from Bill Cowher, got me with Detroit, which I probably would have signed with anyways, but he kind of cemented the deal.
Yeah. That's a similar story. One of your classmates, but somebody else that went to Mercer University. I talked with Craig Woodard, not too long ago, probably about a year ago. We were talking about his experience. He had a tryout after he played for Mercerhurst University and ended up going down and, you know, Cowher came out and made sure he shook his hand and everything. He thought that was pretty cool. Here's a guy, just one of the guys are just bringing in, to play him, maybe, you know, not make the team or make the team, but you know, these free agents coming in, and Cowher made sure he went and met all those. So it's good to hear that he did that with you too. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. He was definitely like a player's coach. And this was, I think, his first year in the NFL, first or second year, but he was just someone, as soon as he starts talking to you, like, I mean, the first five or six questions weren't even about football. Like, he asked me, like, you know, what I went to school for, what I studied, you know, like where I'm from, you know, just all these, like, you know, just like personal questions. And then he got into football, and then I must've been in there for a half an hour. I mean, he just kept talking. And then he started telling me, I think he grew up with Kevin Colbert, and like, he was like, oh yeah, I knew him from Crafton. So like, it was just, you know, he was just like, just like the quintessential player's coach.
That's definitely good, refreshing to hear. You always think of these coaches, these curmudgeons at the
right.
You know, they're in their office or they're up on some platform while practice is going on or whatever, and going and really actually meeting the people and getting to know a little bit about them. Very interesting. All right, so you end up with the Lions, and what happens while you're with the Lions? You get into some preseason games.
Yeah, so I got into the final preseason game, which was enough and gave me the film, but. Yeah, so I was there with them for about almost the whole training camp. They had a kicker there, Jason Hansen, who at the time signed the biggest NFL contract ever for a kicker. I think he just signed for like $725,000 a year. And because he just signed it, there was no way I could beat him out. So like they said, like your role is, you know, like, you know, to give him breather, you know, or whenever he needs a breather, and, you know, in case he gets hurt. So it was fine with me, because then there was like no, like any weirdness between me and him. It wasn't like I was trying to take his job. He knew why I was here. So it was like which was different than my next two stops. Was a lot more uncomfortable with the kickers, because I was there to take their jobs. So that made it really good, because then I could just learn from him. You know, I watched him. I've, you know, I checked out his, you know, like studied his routine. So he really helped shift my career beyond that, because he was more focused on quality than quantity. Cause at the time I was more about kicking a bazillion balls. And he's just like, I'm going to kick these 12 right from here. And then I'm going to call it a day. Cause this is what I need to, this is where I need to like, just kind of reinforce or strengthen. So he wasn't surprising that he kicked, I think he just retired like 4 or 5 years ago. So he kicked into his mid 40s, which is insane.
Yeah. It's him and Vinatieri.
Vinatieri, same. At
the same time. And he played forever.
Insane.
So that was that one of the biggest things that you got learning from Hansen, is that, hey, you don't need to, you know, kick a zillion balls, just take a handful and really work on what you think for that day you really want to achieve. That-
Yeah. Because I was a little bit too much of a perfectionist, you know, like I would just kick for like, you know, I'm going to kick 100 balls today, or I'm kick 60 balls. I wouldn't stop kicking until like I hit that number, no matter how my leg felt. And he was more, I mean, he definitely was, had some perfectionism in him as well. I think all kickers do, you have to, but he also was a lot more intuitive. He also spent a lot more time in the film room than most kickers do. So that was another thing I learned from him. I mean, I was really into film as well, but like, he took it to like, to another level.
All right. So you have the bad experience, which I'm sure can't be pleasant at all, of a cut down day. Now, how does that process happen with the Lions? That, I mean, I know we see like in films and, you know, TV shows and everything, you know, cut down day, they have this guy called the Turk knocks on your door and, hey, get the hell out of here, or whatever they do. How is the reality?
It's pretty real. Yeah. It's, it's dreadful. So like, the guy who's a Turk is typically a guy who's like in the lowest of in the hierarchy of the coaching staff. And you can pretty much figure out who he is, you know, just like as camp goes on. And as soon as like there's the first cut, then the word gets out amongst, you know, the guys like myself who are like living in uncertainty who it is. It's always like the same. Like, he knocks on your door and he says, you know, hey, you know, Sean or whoever, like, coach needs to see you in his office, bring your playbook. And so that's code for like, you're getting cut. So, So when I was there, I started hearing these crazy stories, like, you know, like that some guys would like hide underneath their beds. Some guys would like lock themselves in the bathroom. Some would just like sometimes the Turks weren't really good at mixing up their time. Quite often happened between the first session and the second session, right around nap time, when they knew the guys were in their rooms and their beds and they would come in. So like my roommate, that's how he got cut. He was like taking a nap and the guy came in. That was that.
Way to wake up from a nap.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And sometimes you'd come back from practice and you'd see a locker cleared out. And so like the guy might've got cut right before practice. Cause I remember one day I asked when I was first with the Lions, I said, hey, what happened to so-and-so? Why is his locker cleared out? He's like, well, don't you know what the NFL stands for? I said, no, he says not for long. And so that was like a new concept. That was a new term for me, the not for long, but there was cut down days, but you know, sometimes they had to make room, for guys, you know, who are holding out from camp and all of a sudden they're back on the roster. So sometimes they couldn't wait to cut down day and, some random defensive back had to go that day.
Okay. So you end up getting your call and having to have your conversation with coach of the Lions. Where did your career go from there?
Yeah. So from Detroit, I moved to Florida. My agent lived in South Florida. He said, come on down. It's nice and warm. Get out of the north and you can kick year round. So I took him up on that. I moved down to Fort Lauderdale and started training. And that's when I just, once it got to, once the Super Bowl ended, that's when I started to my agent would start making phone calls to get me on teams. Had to fire my agent like a lot of players do, because after like a couple months, it just seemed like he wasn't getting anywhere. So actually became like my own agent, and a friend of mine who I played football with at Pitt, he also would make phone calls for me. And then we're talking about this on for recorded. My dad called me up one day and he said, hey, Mr. Monday, a friend of mine who, you know, owns that gas station, he knows the special teams coach, Tom Batta of the Indianapolis Colts. I could ask him if he'll call the special teams coach for you. I said, yeah, sure, go for it. I figured nothing's going to come out of it. So
you're sitting there thinking, you know,
my dad back in Erie, Pennsylvania, where there's no NFL team, you know, he just thinks he's going to help me out. And I got an agent and I know what's going on in the NFL. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Well, about a week later, the phone rings. I'm like, hello. He's like, this is Tom Bad of the Indianapolis Colts. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. So he's just like, so what happened was, he's like, you know, we're working out this kicker. Would you like to join? The only thing is, you know, we're not going to fly you in. We're not going to pay for your expenses. You have to come here completely on your own. So what was happening, this was code for like, we're already working out a guy that we really like, that we're probably going to sign. And I'm the throw-in guy, but I was like, heck yeah, I'll be there. Cause you know, any opportunity, you know, I'll take. I mean, at the time I was starting to come up with crazy ideas where I was going to like dress up as the UPS guy and walk down to the Steelers again to get a workout. So I was desperate. I was just delivering food out of my car for this like restaurant delivery company. So I'm like, yeah, I'll definitely do it. My wife was about 6 months pregnant at the time. And so we get in the car, we drive there, and we cross the Indiana border, and we get those, you know, those coupon books for the discount hotels. So we get the discount hotel. We're staying near the Colts complex. And so I work out and I get there, and like, you know, I could tell like the kicker is like, you know, like, what's this guy doing here? The throw in, like, you know, I'm definitely going to beat him out. So it was a really great situation for me, because I had nothing to lose. You know, the Colts think they're signing this kid. This kid thinks that he's signing with them. I'm the kid that they have this like no expectations for. So you know, we would just take turns kicking, and I just let it rip, because I just felt, you know, like really loose about it, that I had nothing to lose. And afterwards, I knew things were good, because like they let him go first, and you know, he was gone, and they asked me to stick around. I'm like, well, they're not going to ask me to stick around if they're not interested. So next thing I know, the head coach walks in, Ted Marchibroda. I'm like, this is another good sign. And then they said, hey,
another Pittsburgh area connection there
too. Yeah, exactly. And then I also see them, they have a check in their hand. I'm like, this is gotta be nothing but good. So they said, hey, here's a check for like all your expenses. And, you know, Ted Marchibroda introduces himself, and, you know, Tom Bada, you know, starts saying all these good things about the workout. And he says, well, we'll be in touch. So, you know, I figured things were pretty good. And like a week later, they called and offered me a 2-year contract, and they said, hey, we want you to come in. And, you know, basically in so many words, they said, you know, they wanted me to beat out, because they had a kicker there that was making, I think, 700,000-800,000. He was in his mid-30s, and I was I was only 25. And so 24, 25. So this is, you know, it was pretty obvious that they're basically saying, come in and, you know, be this, you know, inexpensive second year kicker and beat out the veteran that's taking up a lot of payroll.
and postscript, your father had to buy all his gas from then on from Mr. Mundy at the local Arco.
For sure. For sure. Exactly.
Okay. So you're in Indy. They were playing in the RCA Dome back then. Is that?
The Hoosier Dome.
Hoosier Dome. Okay.
Hoosier Dome. Yeah.
Okay. So what kind of surface is that? That was just carpet, or were they into field turf at that time?
It was still the old AstroTurf, or maybe the new, whatever the new turf was at that time. It's definitely a step up from what I played on a pit, but it was still turf.
It wasn't the carpet on the cement floor. It was a little bit more padded.
No, it was a little nicer. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Not quite the indoor outdoor carpeting anymore.
Right.
All right. So what happens from there?
Yeah. So, unfortunately, I ended up getting cut with the Colts. This is where I discovered that I was having, that I was overtraining, and how my injuries were affecting my endurance. And so I could still kick the ball far. I could still put my kickoffs in the end zone, but the problem was I could only kick for so long. So I could only handle so many reps. And what I discovered the hard way is what kicking veterans do is when their job is on the line, there's a kicker coming in and the veteran has the upper hand, what they'll do is they'll take days off. So the veteran kicker, Dean Biasucci, he was smart. He would just like take a couple of days off, and I would do all the reps, and he must've seen something. Cause what would happen is I would kick double sessions, you know, so I'd kick in the morning on Monday, I kick in Monday afternoon, kick Tuesday morning, Tuesday afternoon. He wasn't kicking. I'm like, oh man, what is going on? So I figured, so then I started to catch on to what was happening, you know, this trick of the trade or whatever you want to call it. And then I started to lose some distance off my kick. So I'm like, okay, so I can, I should, I should just keep my mouth shut and keep kicking and somehow hope I can miraculously keep my stamina up, even though like my hip was hurting, my back was hurting, or B, I could go tell the coach like, hey, could I get a session off? I could use a rest. Cause I'm thinking if I do B, he's going to like lose faith in me and that I'm not sucking it up, so to speak. So it got to a certain point where I knew if I just kept taking all the reps, I would burn out and I'd get cut. So I figured I had nothing to lose. So I went down there. I remember I was like shaking. I was like really nervous to tell the coach this, because you know the mentality of coaches back then is much different than today. Like today, they honor rest and stuff like that a lot more, for all positions, including kickers. But you know, he was more of an old school coach, and I told him, and his reaction was exactly what I thought. He says, PUSSSY, get out there and, suck it up. And, this is you, need to show us that like you got what it takes. And I'm like, cause it was just endurance. And, I wasn't having a problem with accuracy and the mental aspect and all that, but it's like, okay. So I went back out there, and for the next couple of sessions, I did okay. But then there was a session in front of the whole team. The media was there this day, and they allowed fans, and we're doing like 45 yard field goals, and my leg was just aching, and I came up short from 45, which for an NFL kicker, that's it. You can't even come up short for 45 in college. And I'm like, my leg is just shot. And then a few days later they caught me, and that was that.
No, that's a bad thing, especially the way, veterans sort of got you there, like you said. Now as a kicker, I think you alluded to it, but where does the pain start? How do you know when you're starting to go? Where it goes first? Is it like your ankle, your knee,
yeah,
your hip? I mean, what's going on?
Well, when kickers kick too much, it puts strain on their hip flexor, the muscle that connects basically the hip and the upper thigh. So for me, that's like where the pain would happen. So I would like when I'd kick the ball, I'd feel pain there. And then sometimes it would just shoot all the way down my leg to my ankle, because it was connected like to the nerve there. But like what I didn't find out till later, what was happening wasn't just the pain. What was causing my balls not to go as far as I used to was that I was actually tearing that muscle where it was degenerating. So the muscle that connected my hip to the thigh was degenerating. And because it was degenerating, no matter how good my technique was or how hard I hit the ball, it wasn't going to go that distance anymore. It took me a long time to figure out that was actually happening, that my hip was this degenerating. I thought I just like needed rest, but it was probably just like hanging on. I was like literally probably like a thread that I was hanging on to with that muscle.
Well, I thank you. I can't be an easy thing to talk about, but that's a lot of things that people don't understand. People, us and the rest of the world that aren't in that aspect of playing football and kicking. We're just thinking, most people sit there and think, oh, the kicker, he's the guy that comes out. It's either going to screw up the game or, be a hero for playing for 2 seconds. And, they're not real football players. You have all that kind of stuff, but you really have to be athletic and really have to, have strength. You may have to have different training and different muscle groups than some of the other players. You're not strengthening your arms probably as much as a quarterback or a linebacker or something, but
right,
your leg, you gotta, I mean, that's your bread and butter right there. You got to make sure you take care of that weapon.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, the game certainly changed when I got into it, because, because before, like in the 70s and 80s, like there was not kickers weren't making 60 yarders with the exception of Tom Dempsey, and kickers weren't expected to put the ball into the end zone. So like, it's
just, and Morton
it's
just Anderson complete... warming up at the 50.
Exactly.
You're starting out at the 10, he's starting out at the 50.
Right. Exactly. So like it changed. Like, so now, nowadays kickers have to be strong. Like if you can't bury the ball in the end zone, cause the special teams do not want to, there's so many kickoffs, special teams is where the number one injuries are. So that's where they want to minimize that risk. So it's super valuable that kickers, put in the end zone for a touchback.
Okay. That's some great stuff. Now I want to get into, you have a book out and it's titled A Vivid Account of Life in the NFL, An Inspiring Story of Everything That Comes After. What's the whole premise of that, and what's the what was your reason for writing that?
The point after it was the whole idea was, if it first started off as like a yoga book. I was going to as a yoga book for athletes. And I was writing all these, throughout the book, I sprinkled in like what was happening in my football career and how that related to yoga. Anyways, my editor said to me, I was done with the book. At least I thought I was done with the book. It was 300 pages. She's like, no, this isn't the book about yoga. People can find that anywhere. You need to just tell your football story, because that relates to, just life, resiliency, having a dream, finding support system, people around you, friends and family. So she's like, that's the story. So it took me about 2 weeks to realize I had to start a whole book over. So that's what I did. So then I wrote the book from beginning to end. And she said, write everything that happened in your life from when your football career started around age 8 until your career was over, and write a little bit about after over, write that. And then we'll go from there. So that's what happened. I wrote this book. It was 400 pages at that point. I just wrote everything down. She helped me edit it down to 250. And then somehow, I sent this a book proposal out there, and bam, I got really lucky. And I found an agent who was actually a big Jim Harbaugh fan, who he's in the book when I was with the Colts with him. And that's how I ended up getting the book contract with Rowan Littlefield and all that. But so that was the whole idea. It was just initially to share the story about, how life related, to football, and with the hope that people would resonate, with at least some part of my story.
Well, okay. Now you're saying that your publisher had you go back and start at age 8 and start your career. Red flags and sirens are going off in my head. Probably the first thing she's throwing out is like, hey, you got to get rid of this part with these jackwads from Stafford Avenue. You have these people in this book. This will never sell.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot more eerie in the book. I think the eerie went from 100 pages down to 10, but that was her, that was her job. I mean,
she's right.
Yeah, right.
Us knuckleheads didn't need to be a part of your story.
Right.
You had a plan. I mean, that is the greatest part of your story. You're just talking here with me is you having a plan, as a teenager and fulfilling that. I that is very rare, and especially what you chose your path to be in your career. It wasn't like, hey, I'm gonna be a fireman, or I'm gonna be, I'm gonna be an NFL kicker. I mean, wow, that's amazing. That's that's like hitting the lottery.
Yeah. I owe a lot of it to my dad. I mean, Sundays revolved around football, and for us, it revolved around the Cleveland Browns. And so, just watching them every Sunday. So the way Erie works, there were some games that we had to watch the Buffalo Bills, even though there's I never met a Buffalo Bills fan in Erie my whole life up there. But anyways, it's Browns or Steelers. So my dad would take me to a bar across the border in Ohio where they showed the game, just to watch the game. So for me growing up, football was everything. So if I played in the NFL, I was at the top of the world. So I think that's where a lot of that whole dream came in. I was just thinking this crazy importance of football. That's also how I came up with the subtitle of the book, that there's more to life than the NFL, because it took me a while to find that. And I also stole that from Barry Sanders when I was with the Detroit Lions. We were playing the Dallas Cowboys in London, and it was the first or second night, and Wayne Fonts, the coach, he was super laid back. So he let us party 3-4 in the morning. And so I was hanging out with all the rookies, and I came, stumbling back into the lobby after being out all night at the pubs. And Barry Sanders is sitting there reading a Stephen King book. And ironically, I became friends with him during training camp, because he picked me as a catch buddy early in training camp. He just came up to me one day and said, hey, you want to play, let's play catch. And so before we'd go out on the practice field, players would also warm up. This is what I'd do. So I'd play catch with Barry Sanders. And so I was comfortable speaking with him, and we sat down, and I forget the conversations turned to the cuts that were coming up. And I said, I was worried about that, and I didn't know what I would do once I got cut. And he said, hey, one thing you can't forget. He says, there's more to life than the NFL. I was like, whoa, Barry Sanders just said that. But I remember when he told me, actually, I didn't believe him, because I was like, no, that's not true. Which he must have really, really believed, because he retired early when he was on pace to be the all-time leading rusher. So I don't know where he got this early wisdom, because most young players like myself, go through identity crisis once we're cut. But, Barry Sanders at some point, maybe just because of he was so undervalued or you know, under recruited. I think Oklahoma State was his only D1 offer. Like, I think he just was like always like a stronger person. So like, he was like more mature to handle once he got to the NFL. I think he had a higher maturity level than most players do.
Well, that's one way he might've got it. But the other way, maybe while his teammates were out at the pub in London, he was reading Stephen King. He got some wisdom.
Right.
The clown in it or something.
Right. He was always reading, you know, like before practice, really? You know? Yeah. So just a cool guy. Yeah.
Huh. That's a pretty neat story too. Okay. You know, you also have a podcast out, which I'm interested in hearing about, and maybe tell us a little bit about that and where we can find that.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for asking. It's called The Happy Athlete. And so I alternate, I just have one guest per month. You know, one month it's a former athlete, like, and I try to bring on athletes who have, who overcome some adversity. For example, I had a professional woman's snowboarder who had breast cancer, and she's now a breast cancer survivor, and she takes women on snowboard trips. And then the next month I'll have like a yoga teacher, meditation teacher. And then I'll have an athlete. I'm just trying to like bridge this, you know, athletes with, you know, meditation and yoga. And it's been pretty fun. Cause I think, you know, nowadays, you know, athletes have really embraced, meditation, yoga, and, you know, and, you know, non-athletes as well. So, and then I have these people on who have these stories that, you know, just, you know, like my book, I'm hoping that people can resonate with, you know, the challenges that they overcame, and hopefully, you know, people listening can get some inspiration from their stories.
All right. Well, excellent. So why don't you let us know, you have a website, if you want to let people know where that is, and we'll share that with them in the show notes of this podcast as well, and where people can hear your podcast and get your book.
Yeah, sure. Thanks again. SeanConnelly.net. And, you know, the podcast is on my website, but it's on all the platforms, Spotify, iTunes, all that good stuff. My book, you know, it's in all the bookstores. If not, you can ask the bookstore to order for you, or of course it's on Amazon and all the, online websites. It's also on my website as well. So yeah, appreciate that.
Well, Sean Connelly, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming on here talking about, you know, life in Erie as a kid with, like I said, with us knuckleheads at all the way up to kicking in the NFL and now helping people overcome some adversity, because you have a great story of overcoming adversity, both from you know, your personal issues that you had some treatment as a kid, you know, with the ADD, you had a plan and you overcame some adversity of, you know, making it at D3 schools as a kicker, D1 school at Pitt as a kicker, some high pressure kicks, make it in the NFL and succeeding after the NFL. You sir have won a lot in life, and you're now helping others, and my hat's off to you. So great job.
Well, I appreciate that, Darren. And this was so fun in so many ways, especially like going down memory lane. And yeah, just, I'm so glad you reached out to me, and I'm grateful for giving the opportunity. And this was, oh man, I have just so many fond memories growing up in Erie. So this was a blast.
Okay. And I got one last thing to tell, and this is out there to you know, Mike Frawley and Fred, who are always picking, we're trying to get you. I got him first on the podcast. I don't know if they have podcasts, but I got him. He's my pick. So
that's funny
guy. So thanks, Sean, for coming on and spending some time with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks, Darren.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that, Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts. It's found right here on the Sports History Network.